This week on the Media Corps Minute podcast, I sit down with Dr. Katie Post, the owner of Northwest Dental Group here in Rochester, Minnesota. This is a good one. We learn about buying into practices, growing them, expanding leadership, real estate development, buying out partners. There's a lot of fun stuff in this, so stay tuned. It'll be a good one. Katie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Living the dream.
Living the dream. I'm very excited that that we get to have you in today. I know we've been chatting about this for a while, and actually, just in chatting, we learned that we have been on a podcast together.
Correct.
Like 4 years ago or something like that.
I think it might have even been longer.
It could have been
that.
Five.
Yeah.
I think it was probably five.
Yeah.
Yep.
Long time ago with Bucky.
Yep. That's right. That's right. And well, this is fun though. I've been looking forward to this and.
Cool.
Yeah, getting you on and hearing your story. And but before we kind of jump, you know, too far into things, you know, tell us, what is Northwest Dental Group?
Sure. Northwest Dental Group was established back in 1965. So there were four dentists. It was Dr. Rossi, who is currently practicing in Plainview, Minnesota.
Okay.
And Dr. Saws. Back prior to 1965, almost all the dentists in town practiced in this one building downtown. They had like an old elevator, and you'll hear lots of people in town talk about the stories of going to get to the dentist to this old elevator.
And they were all there?
They were pretty much all there, is my understanding.
Why was that?
I have no idea. I wasn't even born yet. And then there were these two Trost brothers. Mm-hmm. And Rossi was actually kind of the mastermind behind it. His family owned the dairy farm that is now Country Club Manor. Mm. And so that all used to be a big dairy farm. And so he got this idea, let's all come together, and then we'll only have to pay for one secretary.
Yep.
And we'll split the cost of the building. And they had these guys were pretty wild.
Yeah.
And so they had somehow found out that John Marshall was going to be built across the street.
Okay.
So there used to be an exit off of 52 right onto 14th Street that would go right to John Marshall. Mm-hmm. And so they bought that lot on the corner of that exit, which was the country at that time. And put up this kind of the state of art building. It was the first dental building in the state of Minnesota that had suction. Really? And ironically, it's a dairy suction that Rossi had picked up from his farm. And it's still a dairy suction in there. That's what we use. I have a dental suction in one of my other buildings, but it's not as effective or like as strong as that one. And it's easier to clean and maintain because they're designed to be cleaned every day with the milk. And it's just a cool kind of concept or idea.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, Rossi had kind of these core values that he was really into. One was legendary service. Like, we are only going to do the very, very, very best work. Mm-hmm. So I saw a patient who's in her 90s, saw him in Plainview, and had these gold onlays and crowns done prior to 1965, and she still has them in her mouth today, which is insane to me that, like, my car that I pay, you know, $40,000 for can't run in 3 years.
Yep.
But these onlays that she had that she uses all the time are amazing.
Yep.
It just shows you what quality work he did. He also was really into education, constantly learning new stuff. He was into quote-unquote technology, which if you call a dairy section that. But anyway, like, he's like, you want to be on the cutting edge, not the bleeding edge of technology. And then he was really into the community. So giving back to Rochester, giving back, like, he did mission trips all over the world, going to Asia to speak and educate dentists there back when it was not really much of an occupation there.
Yeah.
And so it was pretty cool. So these four guys come together. Dr. Saws is still in town. Some Saturdays he'll still show up at that 14th Street location to do lab work.
Yep.
And which is it's a pretty good testament. And so they opened this office in 1965. And then
they all have ownership, or
they all have equal ownership.
Okay.
Well, it's a partnership.
That. Yep.
And unfortunately, Dr. Trost loses a daughter within like 6 months. And then Dr. Bard came in, and that doctor ended up leaving, and Dr. Bard came in.
Okay.
And Dr. Bard was kind of a card. However, he was known throughout Rochester for being really, really good at making dentures, just like high quality dentures. And I think he was pretty good at holding up a bar stool at the country club, but just a fun guy, you know, like everybody loved him. And so they brought in the first hygienist to Rochester, Barb Cleave, and she still comes in at Christmas every year, and you know, we get to see her and her husband and her family, and she's amazing. And was with the practice for over 40 years, and so kind of exciting. And we had the first hygienist, the first suction, and then Dr. Sperling came in, and he's really been my mentor this whole time. Just an amazing man, super involved in the community, in Rotary, super involved in the reading room, involved, president of the church several times, just like an upstanding guy. So the unfortunate thing about Dr. Sperling is he's very fit. So although he's older than me, he acts like 20 years younger than me. And he rode his bike 2 years ago for the West Coast to the East Coast, and not a motorcycle bike, which he does have, but he rode like an actual bicycle bike that you have to pedal. It's insane. You know, so
when we, something he just wanted to do.
So when I first joined and we became partners, then you have to get, like, we had to get life insurance on each other, and for a short time before I ended up buying him out. And his is crazy high risk because he's gone skydiving, he has a motorcycle, he bikes across the country, like anything that's dangerous he does. He climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and he got back, he's like, I thought I was having a heart attack because I was having so much chest pain for the pressure. And he kept going. I'm like, you know. So, but he's also just, he's a great mentor. He's retired now, but still's in the practice all the time. He's teaching over at RCTC for the hygiene students. But he's also helping all of us in our, every month he'll come into the dental meetings and really gets involved with teaching, kind of like walking through cases and how to do them.
So it was you two before you bought him out?
Yes.
But how did that even work? Because when, you know, there's four at one point, how did that
kind of... So when I came to the practice in 2003, Dr. Saz and Dr. Sperling were partners.
Okay.
And then I bought that Dr. Saz out and became partners with Dr. Sperling.
Yep.
And then as things transitioned, I bought him out.
Okay.
And then as we've brought on other people, the hard part is just, you know, like when COVID hit, it was really nice that I was the only one who had to stress about, like, making payroll. I was the only one who has to worry about hiring people or coaching them through. And then my other doctors, they show up, they get to really focus on their patients. Most of the doctors in our practice, they've not only done dental school, but they've also done residency or specialty training. So they have hundreds of hours more CE than most of the other dentists in town. And so part of that is they're not worried about running the business.
Right.
So they can go focus on, like, hey, I really want to be doing implants or doing this or doing that. So I have the time and the money to go invest in myself.
Continual training,
Where when you're running a business, it's hard to do that. You have to, you only have a finite amount of energy, and you've got to spend some of that on some of these other issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I grew up in a small town in Iowa and on the edge of town. And then we owned the farm right next to our town. So
your parents were farmers?
Technically.
Okay.
My dad's really a veterinarian.
Okay.
And my mom was a special ed teacher.
Yep.
And we didn't actually live on the farm. We always rented the farm place out. My dad says he's a farmer, but he does get in the tractor, but it's like he cash rents and has hired men that do all the actual work. But we did grow up like doing 4-H and showing cattle and showing hogs and showing sheep and chickens and
like
horses.
That?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, really good lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Like I regret that I haven't been able to give that to my kids. Mm-hmm. I think my husband's super smart, struggles to change light bulbs. Mm-hmm. So if we lived on a farm, I think that would be harder.
Yep. What, I mean, even with that though, like growing up, being in that, you know, area, your parents are doing that, like, what does that kind of teach you, that environment, you know, that you brought over to what you're doing now?
So with my dad being a veterinarian, I was always, like, we had to answer the phone at home.
Okay.
24/7. So if the phone rang, you had to answer it. And we were trained to answer it in a very specific way. My dad was very detailed about that. So my dad's older brother, who was 10 years older, was also a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. And so was my grandfather, my mom's dad. And so my dad and his brother practiced together until I was in seventh grade. And so that every other night my dad would have call, every other weekend my dad would have call, and they worked 6 days a week. But like the night before my wedding, my dad had 3 calls after midnight before 7 a.m. that he had to go physically leave our house and like go deliver a horse or go help a cow, you know, and that was just my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So even from when I was like 5, if a pig was having a hard time deliver, my dad would wake me up to go because my dad's a huge man, big, tall, strong, like you. And so to get your hand to fit into a pig is hard. And so I would reach in, pull out the stuck pig, and then have to go home and go to school the next day.
Yep.
And that was just sort of part of what we did. And I had to help castrate pigs and do shoot jobs in the snow. I think some of the biggest things I learned is my role definitely was when there was like a car hit on the weekend.
Yeah.
My dad needed an assistant. So I would go in and learning how to deal with people when they're sitting there watching their animal die. Mm-hmm. Or how do you help them through this horrible, horrible trauma in their life and yet give them hope that, you know, maybe we can make it through this.
Yep.
And focusing on doing everything you possibly can to do that, I think you can learn a lot about caring for other people and having empathy for people. I think I also learned, like, we might be all dressed up to go to a wedding and somebody would call their dog was hit and you had to go take care of the dog. Mm-hmm. That always took priority. And I realize now that I'm raising a 12-year-old girl, she needs that because she's so dramatic and everything is about her. And so, you know, I think that was a good lesson that I learned.
Right.
My dad loved like his clients, you know, and it's funny, he can run into somebody and he can tell you what their dog's name was, but can't remember their name, which I think is super funny because the dog's been dead for 20 years. He also would take me with to collect money from, people who owed bills. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important thing to learn how to do, too. How do you be respectful if somebody's really going through a hard time, but yet you still have to get paid to pay your bills? And it was a great way to learn lessons. And it was great to be able to go with my dad to learn how to buy farms. I remember one of the first farms he bought, like him sitting in his office with my brother and I and breaking down the numbers and how do you afford this? And I think if I have it right, he paid the first farm he bought on 18% interest. Is that insane?
That's wild.
That's insane, isn't it?
Yep.
And
take credit card right now. Yeah.
Exactly. And I don't think, he thought it was a great deal. Mm-hmm. And honestly, that was the farm that was right by our town and ended up being just a blessing for all of my siblings and myself. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, it was probably worth it. Yeah. We just didn't think so, you know.
I mean, you learn, one, just a ton of hard work.
Yeah.
You know, that this has to get done now. It takes precedence. Like, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
But also, the finance side is super interesting and be able to sit and learn that. I think it's super unique.
Yeah, so my dad was like an incredible teacher, and I was really blessed that he was good with all four of us at letting us be a part of the business and really seeing. So when I was in seventh grade, my dad and uncle had a falling out. And my dad left that practice, went down the street. I mean, our town is like 500 people, so it's not that far. And started his own practice and was successful. Like very, and my uncle's was still successful too, which is great. But I think I learned so much from that, and how to do that, and how to market that, and you know, how do you go when you, my uncle still had the old phone number. How do you get it out that you have a new phone number and make that successful? And I think that when I have patients that come in there and major trauma in their life, I'm like, this might be the best blessing that you ever have. And you might be teaching your kids so many things that, you know, there's a purpose to this and you don't even know it.
I mean, and you appreciate it now, obviously. When you were that young, do you think you appreciated everything then?
I think it was, you know, my parents really did a good job of not like freaking out about it or getting stressed out about it. And where I think if I would have had to go through that, I would have really been stressed out. I think the hardest part for us is our families were so intertwined and so close that, you know, I think that was a little bit tricky. And that's why I think probably the driving force for me not having a partner.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense. I mean, being able to see that firsthand and going, I'd rather not deal with, you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, kind of growing up, where did you end up going to college then?
Yeah. So I grew up, I graduated from Ballard of Huxley. Okay. Sounds really crazy.
Yep.
It's because there's four tiny towns that make up one small school. It's a phenomenal school. Yeah. It's a great school.
Sounds like a really fancy name.
You know, there's a lot of like D1 athletes that have come out of this small town that have kind of done some great things. And my, you know, one of the original founders from Google came out of there.
No way.
Yeah.
That's great.
And just some crazy successful people have come out of there, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
The so I went there for undergrad or for high school, and I went to Iowa for undergrad and grad school.
Okay.
So I was a microbiology major at the University of Iowa, and I was a tri-delt, Delta, Delta, Delta. Can I help you? Help you? Help you? And so I was did 3 years, finished in 3 years, and then went to dental school.
Nice.
And then I did residency at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics.
Okay.
So focused on oral surgery. And then my husband, Jason, matched at Mayo. And so I started at Northwest Dental Group.
And you, I mean, so you obviously knew you were going to go into dental school, you know, kind of going into college then, right?
No.
Really?
No, okay. I actually was going to go into medicine.
Okay.
And I thought neonatology. And my freshman year, I was lucky enough to get hired in the NICU at Iowa. They have a huge NICU, actually. And so I got hired in what's called the parent connection. And I oversaw like 400 volunteers. And if you had a twins in the NICU and one died, I would set you up with another couple that had twins that one died within the last couple years. Because nobody can really understand what you're going through like they can.
Right.
And so, and then I was really fortunate, like my office that they gave me was right next to this guy, Kevin Ault, and he's an OBGYN. And he was doing research, and then maybe my sophomore year of undergrad, he came to me. And I had gotten them to know them so well. His wife went into preterm labor and ended up naming their baby Katie. And which, you know, was just, I ended up super close, still talk to them today. And he was doing research on what became the HPV vaccine. And I got to jump into that lab and work in that lab with him, and which was amazing. The disconnect was I became close with his wife, and Kevin worked 100 hours a week all the time, flying to a million different countries, trying to get the word out about HPV and cervical cancer. And if he wasn't doing that, he was delivering babies at 2 a.m. And I thought like, okay, my dad's worked all the time, 24/7. And, you know, he's working all the time and I want to be a mom. And how do you balance that mm-hmm. with this? And so I was going on a date with a guy, and he's like, hey, do you want to go to the pre-dental club meeting with me? And
that's quite a date.
Exactly. And we walk into this dental club, and I know everybody there.
That's hilarious.
And I get elected vice president. I don't even know what a molar is. And this lady, Miss Brown, recognizes my name from the HPV research. And mm-hmm. I had donated stem cells, and the University of Iowa did this big publicity thing with me mm-hmm. for that, promoting people to register to donate stem cells. Mm-hmm. And because it was kind of a new, donating bone marrow was a new yeah. sort of, at Iowa, I don't know, from my perspective. So anyway, they, she recognized it and she's like, have you ever thought of going to dental school? And I was like, no. She's like, oh, you should apply. And so she calls me again the next day mm-hmm. and says, will you take this DAT? So I take this test and I get into dental school. And then the guy next to me had applied 8 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
And he was so mad. But so I was the youngest in my dental school class, but it worked out really, really well. And from the moment I started, it's the only job I could talk all day and nobody can talk back.
I mean, getting into it, just kind of falling in love with it then.
Yeah. I've always been somebody, I loved working with my dad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's definitely a part of the lives still to this day, even though he's been retired 10 years, of a lot of his clients. And I think they really respect, like, you know, his involvement with the community and what he did. And I really feel like I've been able to do that with dentistry. Mm-hmm. But I loved artwork as a kid. I love to paint and draw and work with my hands. And I'm able to do that as a dentist.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah.
So even fast forward to now, you guys moved to Rochester. You start working at Northwest Dental Group. I mean, what does buying in look like for that first partnership then?
Crazy, crazy stressful.
Okay.
Because it feels like a lot of money.
And how long? I mean, is it like immediately or is it like, you know, you work?
No, so Jason was a resident and internal medicine is a 3-year residency. And so it was that 3 years. And then he was lucky enough, they picked 3 people out of each class to be chief. I think that year they might have had 4. They did have 4 his year. And so we didn't know if he would get hired at Mayo. And we didn't know, you know, where we would go or what mm-hmm. that would look like.
Yeah, so you weren't looking at locking in anything at this point.
No, I was just looking at, you know, trying to do the best I could. There's a lot to learn when you first become a dentist. And, you know, a lot of things... like just how do you take care of patients and what does that really look like? And so I was working 5 days a week and then doing the business stuff and education stuff on Saturdays as mm-hmm. much as I could. And then I think in 2008, then that buyout happened and that transfer of ownership. So.
And that was a partner or that was 100%?
I became a partner at first and then bought him out completely.
Okay. And that was in 08?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then, but you know, I have to give a lot of the credit to Dr. Sperling. Mm-hmm. When I came that first year, I think I was only there 6 months and I convinced him to switch to digital x-ray. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a tenth of the amount of radiation. Your team isn't exposed to chemicals. It's so much safer for your team. But as a dentist, it used to take us 2.5 minutes to process one film. Like if you're doing an x-ray where it's instant with digital. And so it's just so much faster as a provider of what you can do with that. And so he let me do that. And then, you know, initially we were still doing like paper books and we converted that to computers. Then we converted it to computer notes. Mm-hmm. And when I first started, it was really taboo to do any marketing as a dentist. Mm-hmm. Like you just didn't do it.
Nope.
And that has really changed. And he was really great about like, well, let's try this. Let's try that. And oh, you know what? That didn't work. And so I didn't know anything about marketing. And he was really good about like helping me test it. And he would come up with this crazy idea and then I would go do it. Mm-hmm. And so he's definitely the visionary. I'm definitely the implementer. And so as he's retired, then I have tried stepping into that visionary role that he had.
Push more into that. Is that kind of when you learned, you know, EOS was...
So EOS, I, you know what? It was. I think I... So about that time we hired, when I, that 2008, when I became bought in, I said to him, I'll buy in, but only if we can hire a consultant.
Okay.
And in true Sperling style, he hired three. And so we hired three, and one of those three I'm still with today. And so it's the Practice Growth Institute out of Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And so through that, one of the guys that I was like sitting on the plane with going down to a meeting, he's like, well, you should read this book, Traction. And have you read Traction?
Yeah.
It's like a great book. Mm-hmm. And it's an intro into the EOS system. And so in, you know, I tried starting to kind of instill some of those meetings. I probably went a little overboard at first and then went to death by meeting. But
and was that self-implemented or
did that was self-implemented. Okay. Yep. So I had it self-implemented for about 10 years. I tried to bring in an EOS, mm-hmm. Two different kind of facilitators. I would say...
Didn't go how you wanted it to?
No, and definitely my team felt like it slowed us down from what we were doing. And again, you only have so much time.
Well, yeah, and if you're doing it yourself too for so long and then having someone,
yeah,
almost feels like backtracking. And
I'm not sure in dentistry that we have the margin to cover the expense of some of those guys. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't what I wanted to spend the money on. I'd rather spend the money on like a
Isn't it usually like $10,000 a day?
It's insane. Yeah.
Like, I mean,
yeah.
If someone said that, I was like, no, I'll just read the book and try to do this myself first before ever.
And I know that there's like, Brian would say, hey, you're an idiot. You should just hire them and it's worth the money. But his deal is a lot bigger than mine. And so I think there's probably a line there in the sand where it's when it is more valuable. It's just not.
Yep.
It's not for me, for the amount of my profit it takes.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, even with that, when you bought in, how many like was it just the one building?
It was the one building, 12 treatment rooms.
Okay.
At that point, we still had four doctors.
Yep.
So there were two associates at that time: Tracy Toft, who's in Stuartville, and Matt Penns, who's down on Second Street.
Yep.
And oh no, it wasn't Matt Penns. It was Tim Hansen, who's still with us.
Okay.
And Tim has really stepped up into some of those roles. Tim and Dr. Vanderburg, mm-hmm. Rob. And as I've gone into visionary, they've kind of stepped up into more of that implementer role and helping me with that stuff. So
how do you, I mean, what's your vision then? You're like, you buy in, and it's like, I mean, you turned it into a fairly large practice. I mean, what was kind of the goal? Is that something you knew you were going to do, or?
So when Jason matched up here, there was only two opportunities that I had, like from what I could find from calling around. So one was with Northwest that at the time, honestly, didn't pay that well. And then the other one was with a large corporation, and that was in Chatfield. That practice is now closed. Mm. And I would have really loved that Chatfield practice. But when I interviewed with the owner, he like had this fancy office and this big desk and just looked like money, money, money. And when you went in, he was very strict. Like, you won't pick any of your materials. I'm picking all the materials. And when I asked about some of the materials, like the kind of composite, it just wasn't the quality of what I was accustomed to, which was dental school, and looking back is pretty low bar.
Yeah.
And then I had to use his lab and I had to pay for the lab fees. And then there was just like all these other things. And I was like, and then as I've been a dentist for the last 20 years, corporate dentistry has just taken over. And I don't know that I have the same core values of what they really want or what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so my whole thing has been, I want to create an environment that you can come in, see your patients, use the best quality materials that you can do, and feel like, you know, now do we have a smaller profit margin? Yes. Mm-hmm. But can we still pay the bills? Yes.
Yep.
And I kind of feel like if you do good work and you're ethical, that like the money flows.
Yep.
You'll be fine.
Yeah. Take care of people and it's going to work out kind of.
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah. I mean, you're moving over to there, but I mean, from what you've built just with one to multiple, it doesn't seem like the path that most dentists take is building this larger, you know, multiple location, practice. How did that, come to mind and fruition?
So Sperling gets this idea one day, and at the 14th Street office, there's this tiny little conference room that can fit like two chairs. Mm-hmm. And whenever he got a big idea, he'd be like, come in here. You got to come in here. And I'd be like, I got patients to see. And he'd pull me into that little room. He's like, I think we should build a new office. Jeff Brown has the perfect location. And so we go meet with Jeff, and we end up buying the land next to C.O. Brown. Mm-hmm. Now I tell people it's across from Costco. But at that time, that was a dairy farm.
Costco, yep.
And so it was right next to C.O. Brown. So we sign on it, and the diggers start digging, and he takes off on a trip for 6 weeks, or sabbatical for 6 weeks, while I build a building, and which was probably, a huge blessing that he just let me pick everything, like from the equipment standpoint. It could have been a
hassle if you're both trying to do that.
Yeah. And we never ever disagreed. He was really great about that. Probably more so than me. And just like, we would sit down to pick the paint color, and we'd both just agree on the color, and it would be good. And so, but that, we had a great builder, and it went up really fast. And so that was in 2011. So as we're building that, he's off on this sabbatical, and my best friend's dad, my best friend from dental school, her dad was a dentist in Sioux City, and he built a new practice 10 miles away. Mm-hmm. And he thought he had sold his building to a real estate agent, but really he sold it to a corporate dental office. Mm. And over half of his patients stayed with that original practice, or initially that's what they had felt.
Yep.
And then I got super nervous about selling my building. And that our plan had been to just sell the building and move into this new building when it was done.
Entirely over, yeah.
And we freaked out enough that when we finished the new building in 2011, I moved over. Sperling was going to move with his team, and I was going to stay at the old office a week before he freaks out. So I move and he stays, and which I totally understand. He had this huge practice. Hmm. I didn't.
Yep.
And whenever you move into new construction, people think it's going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. At least in the old building, you know where all the little holes are and how to plug them. Yep. You don't know that in the new building yet. And so we went over and opened it. But that was in 2011, and it has 21 treatment rooms. Mm-hmm. We were able to keep both completely full.
Wow.
And and then Dr. Nolting had come to me and said, hey, I'd love to be a part of Northwest so I can be a part of the CE and a part of the learning and mm-hmm. just the community of dentists. And so we merged there, and Byron became part of our practice.
Okay.
And then I used to live up by 37th Street. And so watching the Blockbuster just sit there after Ace Hardware. And,
yeah.
And then so I got this idea.
I used to work there at Ace Hardware.
No way.
That location, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did a stint there for, it was probably just over a year. I just started just doing whatever, worked up to, assistant manager. And
you were?
Yeah, so I would have, a crew in there with me every other day or whatever, and,
It's a great location.
It was good. I mean, it was fun. I learned a lot. That was kind of like one of my first experiences having people under me.
Yeah.
Where I could, I was responsible for them, but also, you know, training and whatnot. So it was fun. Yeah, I liked it, but it's just funny.
How did you get pulled up into that assistant manager's position? Did you always know you wanted to be in leadership?
I think so. I mean, I've always been a leader in my friend groups and, you know, this and that, but I think anywhere I've worked, I've tried to grow up through the ranks pretty quickly. It was just all, I mean, even before that, I worked at a Christian camp and started as just, you know, doing they called it pros, but it was basically landscaping and yard work and, you know, trash and just everything that helped operate. But, you know, one guy left and there was like eight of us and they had me step up into the position. So, like, that was great. And so it's always kind of been like that. And,
yeah.
But I don't
did
know
if
it's just
me.
Did
you do the landscaping before or after the ACE?
I think it was after, actually. Yeah. And it was
why did you end up leaving ACE?
To go to a Christian college, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So I left there, went to a college, and I did the camp maybe before that, before ACE. Because, yeah, I did ACE. Yeah, I did the camp, then ACE, just because, like, the camp, I mean, you're getting paid. I was getting paid $50 a week. I was an intern.
Yeah.
Full-time, 14-hour days, getting paid $50 a week, and you're not doing it for the money.
No.
You know? And when I got that promotion, like, the pay, like, doubled, but it was still, you know, nothing. And but it was great. I mean, you learned so much out there, and I lived out there full-time, and but that was kind of the first developing, you know, leadership skills. And then ACE, I had a buddy there, you know, that kind of got me a job. And again, you step up and you outperform. So they see that in you and it's like, hey, we need more people like this. So I got to do that. But it was still, I mean, I wasn't like, I'm going to be here forever.
Yeah.
So went to the school.
Which college did you go to?
Really, really small school out in LaGrange, Wyoming. And it was called Frontier School of the Bible.
Nice.
It was only a Bible school, and because my dad was a pastor, and I was like, you know, he believed every one of his kids should at least go to a Christian school for 1 year, and so I went there. I really, really enjoyed it, but I did a semester, and I was like, yeah, I just don't think I'm gonna go into the ministry. So it was a blast. I mean, I had so much fun, but I came back. I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm gonna go back. And I was at church, you know, almost the next day, and a guy came up. He's like, hey, your dad said you're back from college. You want to come in for a job interview? And I was like, sure, you know, I'm looking for a job. So it was just Monday. I walked into the guy's office. There's three of them sitting there. I was across the table and had an interview. They hired me on spot, and that was KFI Products out of Spring Valley. So I was there for 3.5 years before I started this.
Okay.
But even there, you know, I started low level doing tech support.
No, wait, when did you do the Rochester or the landscaping place in Rochester?
That was while I was at ACE.
That was while you were at ACE.
I snowplowed during nights. So I'd work.
That was when the truck accident happened.
Yep. So I'd do days at ACE and then I'd go work nights at that and I never slept. And
you're kidding me.
I was commuting back from
Rochester you had to leave for school.
And it was just like, yeah. I remember, like, I mean, I would literally work a day shift, 8 hours. I'd go plow all night long. I'd get a couple hours of sleep at my buddy's house. I'd go back to work, and then I'd do it again. Then I'd have to drive home an hour to Wabasha, and this pattern just kept happening. And snowplowing was fun, but like you can't do both.
Oh my god!
It was rough.
How did your dad instill in you to work that hard?
I mean, he always worked hard, but my dad he's always been a saver.
Yeah.
And it's paid off really well for him because he's been debt-free most of his life. He's paid for his homes in cash. He's been able to, because, I mean, in ministry, he's not making that much.
Yeah.
He'd never made probably over, you know, 50 grand a year when I was growing up. And, you know, just by saving, we were able to have decent homes and be able to, you know, and it was never
put
new
food
stuff
on the table.
And put food on the table. So I always appreciated it, but at the same time, I always like wanted stuff, and I'm like, I could never have it. I could never buy it. So really early on, it was like, you need to, if you want that, you got to go make money and get it yourself, because like we don't have the money to just buy these things, you know.
Yeah.
So there was always like, here's the basic stuff that we'll help with, and if you want over the, you know, and above that, $100 shoes while you're growing up in high school, we're not going to buy those. But if you want to work and buy your own nice shoes, you can. So there was this, you know, I appreciated it, but I didn't like it. I'm like, I gotta make money. I gotta be doing stuff. So I always like worked hard to like get things that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so I would mow neighbors' lawns and, you know, do different stuff. But, and it was never because I'm like, oh, like I have this grind work ethic. It was like, no, I wanted something and I figured out a way to go get it. And it was through, you know, working and making money.
What did you want badly enough that you would work all night long?
You know, you're young. Like your buddies are doing it with you. I mean, if you're up all night plowing, drinking energy drinks, and eating Quick Trip, you know, it was like
we were just having a blast.
And so it was probably just more money and just fun,
yeah,
to do. And it's like, you know, why not at this age? We're trying to make money and buy things. And, you know, he bought a nice truck, so then I want a nice vehicle and, you know, things like that. And so, yeah, it was always like, you figure out what you want. And it was,
yeah,
like, so my dad, you know, mentality is, you know, save. And I'm like, you know, I would rather go, well, I just need to make more. Like, I don't need to save more. I need to make more, you know, then I'll keep spending. And so I've been a spender at heart all my life. I never have money in the bank. I just, whatever I get, I spend it, and I go figure out how to make more. And,
yeah.
My wife has been very good at being the opposite and keeping me at bay. And so,
how is Jake with that?
Oh, he's the opposite. He's a saver. I influence, you know, him and my wife to an extent to be a little more open with spending money.
Yeah.
But
you need a little bit of a yin and a yang there, because you do, mm-hmm, like, I always tell my kids, like, when you're playing Monopoly, you can't save so much, mm-hmm, because if you're not willing to risk a little bit and go after it, you're going to lose.
You're going
to,
yeah.
But you also don't want to spend all your money so you can't pay rent.
Yeah.
And that's the yin and the yang, is how do you hit that? And I think you're either one or the other.
So, yeah, they're savers, and I was, like, paycheck to paycheck kind of person, because, you know, that's just what I...
There was a hole in your pocket.
If I saw the money there, I'm like, oh, that's my... I get to go spend this now on something. And
okay, so what's on your list right now? If you had $1 million, what would you go buy?
I mean, personally or business-wise?
Personally.
Personally, I mean, right now, I think the next thing is, like, land and building a home. Like, I want to have
You want land. Acres, like 80, or would it be like
40? Yeah, 40. 40, 50, enough room where I can, you know, shoot guns and drive four-wheelers and be a ruckus to all the neighbors around.
Yeah.
But I've always wanted that, and but I've always been a huge host. Like, I want to bring people in, throw parties, have, you know, gatherings. And so when I build my home eventually... what we're planning on doing, I want to build it to like host.
Yeah.
So everything will be tailored to just have people, you know, because.
So will that be in the house, or will you have like a separate barn or a separate building that you have like all these parties at?
That's a good question. I would say, you know, in the house, but it could always do that. You know?
Yeah. So yeah. My hometown MD, mm-hmm, he has this amazing setup where he has this beautiful house, and then he has like it's technically looks like a barn, but it's, yeah, like a big party house.
Yep.
And everything is set up there for like, you can pull up and have a big party.
That's a good idea.
Because then if the kids are asleep in the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be separate and you're not making it. Yep.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, 40 feet away from his house. I think he has a basketball hoop in there, you know, like, yep, the whole get up. And
maybe that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's a fun idea. It's,
yeah,
at least always been on the back of my mind. Like, oh, that would be super fun.
You know. Well, yeah, I mean, it's, and I got to have a spot for, you know, the toys and the, you know, the razors and the boats and,
yeah, yeah,
stuff like that. And,
oh, it's, you know, so just great to dream before you have kids, mm-hmm, and they murder all of those dreams painfully and slowly. My kids are honestly great. It's just like, if you think you don't have money now, wait, yeah, till you're like driving them to hockey and football and everything else every 10 minutes.
How did you, I mean, obviously like you grew up without, you know, a ton of money. I mean, you guys, I don't think you're struggling, right? You know, but.
Oh, no, actually, financially, my parents were.
Were pretty set.
Just fine.
But you, I mean, you still like worked really hard though. And, yes. You know, had that.
Yeah. My dad and mom both, they're hard workers.
Yep.
They both, and my mom stayed at home until I was in middle school.
Okay.
I don't know exactly when she was a special ed teacher, but even then, both of my parents were just hard workers. Okay. My aunt and uncle, he was the other veterinarian, they lived a mile from us. They're very hard workers, both mm-hmm. of them. And just on both sides, both of my grandmas, super hard workers.
Yep.
Just it was, and in both cases, both of my grandmas really worked a lot to support. You know, I come from I call it like a traditional, like my brothers had to work more physically on the farm than I did. I had to do a lot more of like the cooking and cleaning with my sister. But we all had to do kennel chores, which is like where you go take care of the animals at the vet office. We all had to help somewhat with chores. And so that was always sort of part of it.
Yep.
But they were hard workers. But I also had the opportunity to like go to Europe every summer and
nice.
Like play whatever sport I wanted to play. And I always had nice shoes and clothes. And, you know, I don't think that I was definitely, I'm like a chipmunk. I have money stashed everywhere. And I was more like Jake, my brother Matt, and you would be like best friends. And Matt is like so popular. He doesn't even live here, and he'll come in town, and all of my team will be like, why can't you be fun like Matt? And so I think sports have always been really prominent in our family. Mm-hmm. Lots of sports, but
even for you.
Yeah, you know, I was the least athletic of the four of us.
Okay.
By far. There's not even like nobody would even argue that with you. I did start in four sports. I played five, you know.
That's not bad at all.
No, I mean, yeah.
That's
not was good at golf. Started on the volleyball, basketball team, softball, you know. So I ran a pool in high school and made quite a bit of money doing that. Mm-hmm. Had like a couple baseball fields, some tennis courts, and a concession stand. That was my first intro into management. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was. And part of that trained lifeguard. So always swimming has always been a part of our family. And my mom did the same. My mom and dad actually lifeguarded together in high school. And then my mom ran a pool. And, you know, that was kind of a big part of her kind of story too. And I think I was able to learn how to do that from her and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. I think a lot of my empathy comes. My mom was really good with special needs, special ed kind of patients. And she would make us go into the classroom and spend time. And I think that was really great for me to realize that, you know, initially you think, oh, my life is so much better because they have this physical disability, but that's a little arrogant and their life can be really great and fulfilling and happy too. And mm-hmm. so that was kind of a good intro into that. And, I was really fortunate that way.
Yeah.
That's my husband.
But not in like a spoiled way though. Like you had to like work.
Oh no. Spoiled run.
You were?
Totally.
What?
Obviously. Yeah. If you ask anyone, my parents were like, they pretty much lived for us four kids.
I love that.
And everything was spent on mm-hmm. the four of us kids. And I have.
My parents do that. You know, they'll live a certain way just to like give it all to their kids.
Yeah, 100%. And I would say that my grandparents also did that mm-hmm. on both sides differently. So I felt very lucky there. I would say that it's interesting. Like I take my husband and his brother, you know, exact same upbringing, exact same genes, exact same amount of no money or money given to them, and just sort of the reaction to that is very different. So I'm not sure that that, in my opinion, I think the person is going to be what they're going to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, money usually just elevates what you know, who you already are.
Yeah.
It's not going to, doesn't necessarily like change it. It's more,
it can
whatever
bring
good
out
or bad personalities you have and attributes, that's just going to enhance.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah. I lots of times feel like I might be the least successful of my siblings too. So I think just like that expectation to always climb and do that. So
when did the real estate side kind of come into play? Because I know you dabble a lot.
Yeah. So my dad owns a lot of real estate.
Okay.
My mom's dad, who was also a veterinarian, owns a lot of real estate or did farmland. And then my dad took that over. And my dad's parents, they were in their mid-40s when my dad was born. So initially, they had left Iowa and gone out to Wyoming and homesteaded, like the old white flag in the ground kind of thing.
That's awesome.
They lived in a hole in the ground, like a hut, or I forget what they called it. There's like a little dome. And they ate lard sandwiches the first year. And my grandpa would have to hunt elk to like eat.
Yep.
And if you survived for 3 years, you could sell the land and keep all the profit off that land. So they survived for 3 years. She was pregnant when they moved out there. They had the first baby by herself out there. They survived the 3 years, sell the land and come back. And it was enough money to put a down payment on a farm in Iowa. And by the end, they had 8 kids. One passed away early on the farm. 7 kids, they each got a farm by the time they graduated. I mean, that tells you how hard of workers they were, but they were also good at buying land. Mm-hmm. And so I think that whole real estate play that I do has always been in my family. Mm. I've just done it with buildings instead of farmland.
And you're still pretty active in that, right? You're always
always buying.
Yep.
Or I like to think I am. Yep. In fact, my brother called me last night, and he's like, oh, look at this in Ames. You should, you know. I'm like, well, you could
buy it. So it's like all the family.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're sending properties and this and that. Like, hey, you know, check this one.
Yeah, yeah. My sister is, she is in, she's also in education. She was in the assistant superintendent in Philadelphia. They have like 210 schools in that district. Mm-hmm. She was head of their special ed, and then she moved to Door County, I think it's called. It's just south of Manhattan. And she oversees their early childhood development now there. She's not into real estate, per se. Mm-hmm. She's really into the education scene and the whole logistics and, you know, laws and everything behind that. But the rest of us are pretty much into it.
Mm-hmm. How else do you kind of like, you know, continue to develop yourself? I mean, coaches, masterminds, you know, things like that.
How
do you keep pushing?
Yeah, I'm still in this group in Atlanta. So every quarter I spend at least 1, if not 2 days with them. Mm-hmm. And that's dentists that are my size or bigger from the entire country. So it's a group of like 16. And that's been really great. I'm in a C12 group, which is a Christian business group with you. Mm-hmm. And we meet for a full day once a month. And I would say that has, in the last couple of years, that whole Christian piece has become more and more a big deal to me. It's mm-hmm. always been a part of my life, but not at a deep level like you.
Why do you think that is?
I think, frankly, because I didn't take the time to prioritize it. I didn't take the time. It was, you know, it's always been a part of my life and meaningful, but not as, like, intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say C12. When we're there, I'm not sure that that's even a huge portion of it.
It's not.
I feel like 90% of it is about business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because, you know, we might have somebody there going through a real, like, difficult part of their business.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really being raw and sharing it. And it's so cool to see these other 7 people and how they might break out of it. And then to actually see the person use that and break out of it and, like, be successful.
Yep.
And that's where that mastermind, like, the magic sort of happens. or like I might just be like blah, 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 blah. I'm doing fine, but just going along, and I'll go to that and I'll really get motivated by somebody like you who really did take something like boom, right? Doing great. And it motivates me to want to go do that. And so I thought, oh God, I don't have an hour, a day, a month.
Yeah.
But it's, I feel like it's really valuable. Do you?
Yeah, I do. Every time before like the meeting, like I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can keep doing this, you know, like, and then I go and then I'm like, okay, like it was really good. Like this, it obviously makes sense to keep doing, but it's hard to give up a day when you're slam busy and you know everything that you got to get done. But at the same time, it's almost like intentional time to work on your business, you know, instead of in it, you know, so I see it as that, but also having access to the room.
Yes.
The people that are there, the education, and then also having a group that you can trust, that you can lean into, that are going to push into you, that are going to call you out, you know. Because I've been in different groups too, and there's...
I have to apologize for that, by the way.
Oh, no. No, you're always worried about that. I'm like, no, this is great. I mean, any client feedback, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah, like, that's how you grow. So that's why I started... I call it the Juniors Club, but I started this little for my son who's 17.
That's awesome.
With Brian McQuilkin and Active PT and Mike Enke with Rochester Motor Cars and Steve with what is the name of his company?
SMB.
SMB. That's SMB, what I always forget that. And I love Steve.
Yep.
So like bringing these high school kids together, and really what I'm trying to do is teach Ethan, how do you mastermind? Right? Because you can grow 10 times faster with a group of people. Mm-hmm. And Dave Ramsey talks about his coffee group, which is his mastermind group. And it's a group of men that just, when they were young, would meet for coffee. And now, once a week. And now, like, how many of those guys are multimillionaires mm-hmm. because of that coffee group? And, you know, like, I'm trying to teach Ethan, you don't have to do this road all by yourself.
Right.
It's a lot more fun to do it as a group. And surrounding yourself with the right people. Mm-hmm. And it's been fun. I think next month we're talking about negotiation, how you negotiate. And it's fun to see these high school kids.
I'm going to join this just to learn.
Well,
I'll be sitting next to your son, like, teach me how to negotiate.
It was so cool. So we toured West Bank. Or not West. I'm so sorry. We toured Sterling State Bank. Mm-hmm. And Tyler Coleman there was amazing at Sterling. And just like Brian McQuilkin left, he's like, I wish somebody would have explained this to me 20 years ago. And
everybody's learning something.
Yeah. Well, me too. And it was really great about, like, how can you maximize, and you know, he let the kids sit in the boardroom and talk about how they make decisions on what loans they put through. How do you put that together? How can you also invest your money in other ways? You know, like, what does it look like in that? And it was just, Tyler was so good with them. And it was a really cool experience.
That's like really good knowledge to learn and know and understand.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, Brian was talking to Tyler, hey, can I bring my team to Sterling to just see and have you give this to my team?
Same thing, but with my team.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that. I mean, I know we're wrapping up here on time, but what I always like to ask you, what is your kind of just your big motivator? You know, I know things like that change, you know, over the years and as your business and personal life change, but you know, really what pushes you now?
Yeah, you know, our tagline is creating healthy smiles with legendary service. And I keep telling people, like, it actually really works for me because it's one of those things that I want to help people, but I really love 5-star Google reviews. Like, there's nothing better than when somebody is like, I got a text this morning from a patient and just... like somebody who genuinely is glad that you're in their life and they're genuinely thankful that you were there to help them. And I don't think that money replaces that. I don't think anything else replaces that. And so I guess that's my motivation, 5-star Google reviews.
I like that. With that being said, too, like just quick, what do you think makes Northwest Dental Group stand out from the rest?
Our team. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously every dentist in town is trying to pick them off. Mm-hmm. And they are, from the top to the bottom, I'm like, knock on wood, right now, I have just a really good team. I have great doctors. I have great hygienists, great assistants, great business people that are smart, that work hard. And I know it's a time where a lot of people are struggling to get good work, mm-hmm. you know, and they're struggling to get the right team members. And I've been blessed though from the very beginning with that. And I think Sperling created a culture that was really focused towards the team. We try to really take care of them. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely care about them. I think it, you know, with 110 employees at any given point, you have somebody who's going through a major life crisis. Mm. Somebody who has a child with cancer, somebody who had a car accident, somebody who, you know, and just different levels, but they're all important. And I think our team is really good about stepping up and being empathetic towards each other. And I appreciate that. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, great. I mean, culture is massive. Obviously your team and who you're surrounded with is going to be huge into the success of, you know, each person.
I mean, yeah.
You develop them, they develop each other. They help develop you. I mean, it just. And I've felt that when I've been, you know, even just there myself, just, you know, the culture piece that these people love to be here. They love what they're doing. They're passionate about it.
And
a lot of that comes, you know, just with your team. And
I'm really lucky too. Our facilities are beautiful.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, they are.
That new ACE building is just like, if you look at the old ACE building that you spent hours in,
it's not even close.
And I had somebody in it the other day for the first time, and they're like, oh my God, this is like a spa. It's like a super modern spa. And
start adding that into your services. the back room spa.
And so, you know, I feel like that helps the culture. Mm-hmm. We try to do things like we have Peloton bikes and for the team, and we have a whole bunch of things that we try to do for the team. But mm-hmm. I think that just being genuine helps.
Yeah. What's the future look like?
Oh, I'm really hoping my kids' NBA or NFL contracts, they can come off and pay off everything. No, I really actually do hope. I've really brought all three kids in, and I think there's a high likelihood that one of them will end up coming into dentistry, and I'd love to pass the baton on and see how that goes. Ideally for them, my dad was amazing to let me go out and put my own stake in and prove it first. And so that's part of this juniors club. Mm-hmm. Is me being able to bring them into the business. And they've always been there. Anytime I buy a building, they're in the law office with me. They're in the bank. And when I sign papers, they're there. My middle son loves construction, so he likes to be there when they're tearing down walls or mm-hmm. pouring cement or doing that kind of thing. And so I want them not only to hear about it, to be a part of it. But if I have an emergency, they have to go assist me. So they've all, unfortunately, had to assist me pull a tooth on one of their friends or on somebody else. And
you're just trying to instill the same things, though. That's good.
It's passing that baton on.
Yep.
And so ideally, they would be able to make their own mark first and then, you know, be able to, you know, transition over. So... but I want them to live their own journey. Mm-hmm. You know, right now Ethan's just really excited about this next step and mm-hmm. where that takes him.
I think most parents have said they'd obviously love if their kids are a part of it and take it over and do that. But at the same time, they don't want it to feel forced. They want it to be like, if you want to do something else, do it. I would obviously, you know, love if you did this, but this is your choice kind of thing.
Yeah. I think do what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And I have been blessed to love what I do. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, my dad thought I was nuts because he loved so much being a vet. And so he couldn't imagine why anybody would want to be anything besides a vet. No. And so I probably am doing the same thing to my kids, and whatever they choose, they'll be great at too, mm-hmm. you know, all three of them. And so it'll be fun to see how that turns out and what they end up doing.
Mm-hmm. So one last question.
Yeah.
We would, you know, our listener base is, I don't know, people in business, entrepreneurs, leaders, owners, and a lot of people just trying to continue to push and grind and grow. And I mean, you've had a lot of learning experiences over the years and things like that. You know, what would you, what advice would you pass to somebody that's in their journey right now that's trying to make something happen?
Yeah, I would say I typically have three things. My first thing is whatever you really want, write it down, make a goal. Figure out the top 10 steps that you need to take to get it and put that and read that every single day. Just like it says in Think and Get Rich, you know. Number two is find a group of people that you love and trust to mastermind with, to meet with every week and really talk through problems with, because sometimes you're your worst enemy. And, you know, if you're honest and share those goals from the first card with them, they will hold you accountable to that. And so when you sort of like start to lose that motivation or that energy, they pull you back. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really helpful. And I guess the last one is just have a little fun every once in a while.
I like it. Well, Katie, it's been a very, very fun episode. It's been a pleasure to have you on. And I just want to say thanks again for coming in.
Yeah. Thanks, Josh.
Absolutely. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for listening. I hope you learned something. Again, I know I did. I do every time. That's why we continue to do these. And if you learned something, definitely share it out. We're going to keep growing this, the community. We're going to keep getting more fun guests on. And just excited for the next one. Looking forward to it.